from WBUR Boston, I'm Bob Oakes, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's down to the wire, deal or no deal, the make or break moment. Pick your cliche, but this is serious business. When the clock strikes midnight, this country could head over the fiscal cliff, and everyone will feel it. All eyes are on Washington. This hour, On Point, the 11th hour negotiations on the edge of the fiscal cliff. Joining us now from Washington is Margaret Tolove, White House correspondent for Bloomberg News, and also from Washington, Chuck Babington, who covers Congress for the Associated Press. You're both so very, very nice to join us on this last day before the New Year's. Thanks for coming on Point.
Hi, Bob. It's great to be with you.
Thank you, Bob.
Let us ask, in adjourning for the night last night, Senate Democratic leader Harry Reid said that they'd convene today and might possibly have some announcements to make. Does that mean Senate negotiators were working overnight trying to reach a deal? What's the landscape today? Margaret, why don't we start with you?
The landscape today is that they are very much hoping to come up with something that they can pass out of the Senate and get over to the House for a quick vote that does extend tax cuts, at some middle point between the 250 that Obama wanted and the million that Boehner talked about. But then they do have the problem of getting it through the House. And there is a big question mark at the end of whether or not this could actually happen by midnight. Yes, they were talking until late in the night and again early this morning, and there is progress. But as with so much of the rest of the year, getting a deal that doesn't seem that complicated is riddled with complications and potholes.
Chuck Babington, what are you hearing?
Well, we know that Vice President Joe Biden has stepped in a big way to work with Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, partly because they have a pretty good working relationship. Biden was a senator for 36 years, so he very much understands how things work there and sort of how people think there. One thing to keep in mind, Bob, is we talk about if a deal is struck, and that could happen, but that deal would be between the White House and the Senate Minority Leader, presumably the Senate Democrats would buy in. But keep in mind, any one senator can delay action for more than a day. And even if it were to get through the Senate, you've got the House, which, is, of course, controlled by Republicans. We saw what happened when Speaker Boehner tried to do even a very modest tax increase only on millionaires and above, and his Republican caucus wouldn't buy that. So I would just be cautious that there's such a thing as a deal, but there's also a House and a Senate vote.
So I want to ask you, Chuck, has any one senator or have senators told you that they may use that power they have to object and block a deal?
They have not, and I would hasten to point that out. But I'm just saying, a lot of strange things can happen. And again, in the particular rules of the Senate, allow any one member, even if change of heart. So I'm just trying to caution that sometimes we say, oh my gosh, a deal was struck. That could be a very big development, but it's not the end of the game.
Margaret, we've talked about Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid. We've talked about Vice President Biden entering these talks. Among the major power players, who has the power here? Who's in the power position in terms of shaping a possible compromise?
The Tea Party caucus in the House? No. There's so many different ways to slice this. Ultimately, in the end, this deal is essentially between Mitch McConnell and President Obama with Vice President Biden as a proxy. But if it can't be passed in the House, it doesn't happen. And so the entire dynamics of getting deals done in Washington, which already had been changing since Tom DeLay's year, so over a period of many years, since that 2010 election has added a new layer of complication. And, sometimes it's hard to tell whether the dog is wagging the tail or the tail is wagging the dog in Washington. It's been difficult for Speaker Boehner to govern. It has been difficult for longtime veteran leaders who are familiar with sort of the decades-long art of cutting deals to know how the rules have changed. And for many of the members who are on their way out now, like, Ben Nelson of Nebraska, Dick Lugar of Indiana, some of these guys who've, sort of faced, trouble in their own parties as well as opposing parties, they're kind of like almost relieved to be going because all the rules have changed. have changed. And I just want to sort of set the tone. Yesterday, Sunday sessions in the Senate are really unusual, and there's always an opening prayer. And if you look at what the Senate chaplain said yesterday in the opening prayer, I thought it really sort of set the tone for what was going on. He said, "Lord, show them the right thing to do and give them the courage to do it." This is Barry Black, the Senate chaplain. He said, "Save us from self-inflicted wounds." And that was his opening prayer as these guys got started.
Well, let's hear sound bites from Harry Reid and Mitch McConnell from yesterday. Here's the Senate Majority Leader, Senator Harry Reid, saying, whatever they're working on, it's far from a done deal.
We've been trying to come up with some counteroffer to my friend's proposal. We have been unable to do that. I've had a number of conversations with the president. And at this stage, we're not able to make a counteroffer.
And here's the Senate Republican leader, Mitch McConnell, saying it's time for Democrats to stop playing politics and make a deal.
I'm concerned about the lack of urgency here. I think we all know we're running out of time. This is far too much at stake for political gamesmanship.
Are these two guys as far apart as they seem to be, at least in their public comments, Chuck?
Well, really, if you look at the details of what we think the negotiations are, they're not that far apart in actual numbers and details. But politically, I think it's not just that so much that Reid and McConnell are apart, but that their parties are apart. And a very important dynamic here is we, and I think your listeners, for the most part, tend to look at this sort of as a national problem. The nation's economy is at stake, the nation's reputation is at stake. Keep in mind, the only players in this whole thing who are elected nationwide are the president and vice president. Everyone else, all the senators are elected by states, and all the House members are elected by districts, which are relatively small from a national standpoint. And their politics are local, and many of these districts are either very, very conservative or very, very liberal. And in those districts, a lot of these compromises very often are not popular. In fact, they can be fatal. You'll have quite a number of especially conservatives who will tell their member, if you compromise your principles, we're going to vote you out. We're going to defeat you in the next Republican primary.
Right.
You hear this all the time. And once you start looking at this political dynamic through that lens, and that's how these members look at it because they very, very much want to be reelected, then you see why it's so difficult to reach an agreement that a lot of people think should be a no-brainer for the nation.
Margaret, do you want to weigh in there?
Well, that's exactly right. And that's, look, when was the turning point for all of this? Mid-December, it looked like, hey, you know, Obama's going to hop on a plane for Hawaii and everyone else is going to have a nice long Christmas. He and Speaker Boehner were talking. They were looking at one point, as you'll recall, at basically a dollar-for-dollar, trillion-and-trillion deal on revenue and spending cuts. And President Obama, defying the wishes of some in his party, was revisiting this idea of chain CPI, essentially of curbing the growth of, you know, Social Security payouts over time. And so and then Speaker Boehner walked away from the table, and all of a sudden there was a plan B, which would raise taxes on folks over $1 million in terms of income. And guess what? His caucus wouldn't support that either, and they had to pull that at the last minute. And that is absolutely a combination of both the ideological positions of many of these folks in the House who got elected. So they're voting for what, you know, for what they believe and what their position has been. But also they're very real concerned that if they say, well, that's what I believe in, but, you know, I'll make this compromise in this case, that they won't be around 2 years later to have another go at it.
Well, let me ask you where you think the compromise is on the tax question, which has certainly been publicly the top line of this debate. Where is the compromise? Higher taxes for those who earn $250,000, $400,000 or higher? Who gets higher taxed and who gets protected?
Well, remember the president ran for re-election saying taxes should go up on incomes of more than $250,000 for couples and $200,000 for individuals. And these are, we're talking about federal income tax rates. He won the re-election. Polls show that that's still a pretty popular position. But Republicans have been, for really 20 years, their mantra has been no tax increases whatsoever. It's quite a rigid position. It's something that I think would surprise Ronald Reagan and other past Republicans if they were still with us. But that has become the dogma. It's very they're very loath to give up on that. So, as Margaret noted, even when Speaker Boehner tried to pass another bill, the so-called Plan B, that would have raised taxes just on millionaires, so it was four times higher than the Obama threshold, he couldn't get that through his own Republican caucus. So Obama clearly has indicated a willingness to go above that $250,000, maybe around $400,000, which would, you know, catch only a really small percentage of Americans. But for many Republicans, even that is something that they don't want to do because they just say you should never raise tax rates.
Margaret, quick question here before we go to the break. Some analysts, we're touching on this a little bit. Some analysts think the White House won the PR battle about making this about how House Republicans are divided and can't come together. And that's why today we're peering over the fiscal cliff. Do you agree with us? Is the White House ahead in the fiscal cliff PR game?
The White House certainly feels that they're ahead in the fiscal PR game, or at least in the politics game, the pocketbook politics game of what comes home in your paycheck. But on broader questions of debt and deficit, nobody's ahead. Everyone's far behind.
This is On Point. I'm Bob Oakes, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the failed fiscal cliff negotiations, what's happening right now on Capitol Hill, and what's next. Right now, let's go right to an On Point listener who's very concerned about the fiscal cliff talks. Craig is calling from Westport, Connecticut. Hi there.
Hi, Bob. How are you?
Go right ahead. Fine, thank you.
Okay, a couple things. First of all, I think that there needs to be more cooperation, and this needs to get done because there's going to be a lot of suffering across the board with a lot of people. I live in an affluent area, but 20 miles up from me is a large city where there's a lot of poverty. I don't want these poor people suffering any more than they already are. So that's the first point. The second point is I'd like to see some talk regarding this bailout that we gave banks and auto manufacturers, and I'd like to see some effort be made on the part of these elected officials to get some of this money back to reduce our deficit.
All right, Craig, thanks a lot. Margaret, why don't you jump in here and tell me whether you think that his call for more cooperation and a Congress being more in tune with how the public is suffering is actually playing on Capitol Hill.
It would be nice. But here's the lay of the land. And I think if you're a listener at home and you're trying to understand how is this going to affect me and what does it mean if they reach a deal, the fact of the matter is that the scope of any deal they're looking at reaching, you know, before midnight or even in the next couple of days after the first of the year is not the sort of deal they originally envisioned in terms of addressing the big picture worth of stuff. And there's a couple things that aren't going to get resolved no matter what in the next couple of days. And one of those appears to be the debt limit. And what we're looking at is another fight kind of like this in, you know, 3 weeks or a month that goes on for weeks that will seem like deja vu all over again, or may seem that way in terms of what we went through in the summer of 2011. A lot of concern about, you know, credit rating, about a debate about Medicare and Social Security is going to get dragged in the middle of all of this. And at this point, based on how these talks have gone, there's not a lot of reason for optimism that the debt ceiling fight is going to be any more kumbaya than this.
All right, Margaret, thanks. Let's hear from another On Point listener. Paulie is coming from Hyden, Kentucky. Paulie, hi there. Thanks for joining us on this New Year's Eve day.
Hi, Bob. My point is that it's what you sort of mentioned earlier, is that the politicians as a whole are more concerned about being reelected than actually doing what's best for the country, not setting aside their own selfish needs or the need to be reelected as to doing what's right for the country as a whole.
Chuck, you want to weigh in on that? You talked about how you think that some of these congressmen, especially Republicans, are driven by the fact that they're largely in safe districts and don't necessarily need to worry about compromise with Democrats or compromise with the president.
In many cases, they need to worry about compromise because that can be what will drive them from office. And look, the vast majority of House districts, both for Democrats and Republicans, are very safe, and this is a result of long gerrymandering and the way that people move to live with like-minded people. But what we've got now is quite a few cases where, you know, members of Congress are explicitly told that cooperation is a ticket out of office. Just to give you a couple of, you know, an example is, you know, Richard Lugar, the senator, Republican senator of Indiana, in office for many, many years. He lost the Republican primary to Richard Murdoch, who said that Lugar was too quick to work with the Democrats. Murdoch specifically campaigned saying, you know, I will not compromise. Now, he didn't win the general election, but it really was for different reasons. It was for a different topic. You saw 2 years ago where Bob Bennett, a senator in Utah, longtime Republican senator, very conservative, was defeated in the primary process in Utah by a more conservative member, Mike Lee. We're seeing some of this happen on the flip side in the Democratic Party as well, but it's more pronounced in the Republican Party. But, you know, the first caller talked about we'd like to see more compromise, and all the polls will say that Americans want compromise, but Americans need to look at the voting that's going on. In many cases, we are electing people to Congress who explicitly promise not to compromise. So we've got a real dilemma, and very often voters are voting in ways that are counter to what they profess to be their desires.
Let's bring another voice to the conversation now from Washington, Alice Rivlin, Senior Fellow in Economic Studies at the Brookings Institution, whose resume is longer than my arm. She was, of course, a former director of OMB, the White House Office of Management and Budget, under President Clinton. Alice Rivlin, thanks for coming to On Point today.
Hi, Bob. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, too. Let me ask you what you think compromise looks like. Should compromise be reached in Washington between these Republican and Democrat senators who are talking up on Capitol Hill?
I think if we get a compromise before midnight, it will be quite minimal. It will stave off the increase in taxes for most people with some kind of increase at the very top, and that's what they're arguing about. What is the very top? I hope it will solve the problem of the alternative minimum tax. That's an obscure provision, but it would affect an awful lot of people, I think 30 million or something, if they don't fix it. And I hope it will extend the unemployment compensation. That's pretty minimalist. There are lots of things they're not dealing with, even in the context of this short-run situation. And they're emphatically not dealing with the biggest problem, the increase that we face over the next couple of decades in our debt, which was, after all, what started this whole conversation.
Right, the point, right, which was the point of the whole thing.
Well, they're also not dealing with sequestration, are they, Alice? There's almost no talk in the public about the huge cuts coming to defense across the board. No talk in terms of a deal. So are those huge budget cuts also inevitable or almost inevitable?
Well, they won't be part of this quick deal, I think. But let's not exaggerate how terrible it would be if we didn't solve this problem by midnight tonight. There is a possibility, of course, that the Congress could meet tomorrow. But there's also a new Congress coming in at the end of this week, and they will have a chance with the president to revisit this issue if it doesn't get solved and maybe do a better deal. It will be a different situation because technically the tax rates will already have gone up and therefore they would be voting to bring them down, which is something that Congress likes to do. The sequestration, these mindless budget cuts across the board, would technically be happening, so they could alter that. I don't think it's a disaster if they don't get it done by midnight tonight.
And the president almost echoed just that yesterday on Meet the Press in an interview with Meet the Press host David Gregory on NBC. He said, even if the country goes over the cliff, there will be options after the first of the year.
And if all else fails, if Republicans do in fact decide to block it so that taxes on middle class families do in fact go up on January 1st, then we'll come back with a new Congress on January 4th, and the first bill that will be introduced on the floor will be to cut taxes on middle-class families. And, you know, I don't think the average person is going to say, gosh, you know, that's a really partisan agenda on the part of either the president or Democrats in Congress. I think people will say that makes sense because that's what the economy needs right now. So if one way or another, we'll get through this.
Alice Rivlin, agree with the president on that point?
It would have been much better to do it sooner, and I'm sure the president thinks that, too. I would have liked to have seen this problem solved months ago, or never having gotten into this artificial barrier of the cliff. However, given where we are, it's not a disaster if it doesn't get solved right away, because there are, as the president pointed out, plenty of chances to revisit the deal and do something maybe better when the new Congress comes back.
I want to get all three of you to weigh in on this next point that the president also made on Meet the Press yesterday. He said he's offered entitlement reforms. He offered $1 trillion in budget cuts over 10 years. He said it's the GOP that's been inflexible in terms of protecting tax cuts for the wealthy. Is he effective in making that argument? Alice, you first.
He's right that the GOP has been totally inflexible on the tax rate question, and that he and Speaker Boehner were apparently fairly close to a deal, as you noted earlier, a bigger deal with $1 trillion of revenue increases, partly from rate increases and partly from broadening the base, and $1 trillion of spending cuts. The president has never been terribly explicit about entitlement reform, and that frustrates the Republicans, just as the Democrats are very frustrated with the intransigence of the Republicans on the tax side.
Margaret Tulliff, weigh in.
So I guess I would agree that he's been right but not effective. He felt that he gave Speaker Boehner a lot, and a lot of Republicans on the Hill, particularly on the Senate side, also felt like, okay, maybe we shouldn't say anything out loud, but wow, we just walked away from something kind of real. On the other hand, the president's got what he's got. This is the Congress he's got to deal with. And as he heads into a second term, he has got to figure out some kind of a way to change the dynamic, because he has a few pieces of agenda beyond the fiscal agenda that he wants to get done. And if this is the pattern that continues to repeat itself, almost no prospect of getting any of them done.
So when you say he's not effective, do you mean you think he needs to roll up his sleeves more and create the conversation necessary with his political rivals on Capitol Hill to get this deal and then other deals done?
It's not clear that it would make a difference. It's really not. Vice President Biden has been his go-to person because of his longstanding relationships in the Senate when the president wants to have an emissary. I mean, look, many Republicans on the Hill complain that they feel that Obama is aloof or thinks he's smarter than them or whatever. But it's not clear if he was, you know, nice and their buddy or made them feel smarter or whatever, that would make a difference in the dynamic. My point isn't that if he just tried harder, it would be easier. But my point is that being right counts for political points, but it doesn't count in terms of getting stuff done. And he's now, first of all, in legacy mode, where he's thinking about what he can walk away with when he's done being president, what mark he can leave on the country. And he's also still, you know, at least up to his knees in real economic stuff. There are concerns that if this cliff situation and more broadly the debt ceiling and all that sort of stuff in the next quarter, in the first quarter of the next year, that if this stuff isn't resolved better, that we could slide back toward recession just as we're climbing out of it. And look, when you're the president, the buck stops with you. It doesn't stop with an individual House member in a red state in a safe district. It stops with you, and he's got to deal with that.
Chuck Babington, the president's been out campaigning across the country for his fiscal cliff solutions. He's talked to at least one Sunday morning program, but is he doing enough retail on Capitol Hill?
Well, I agree with Margaret that the president, he's a Democratic president. I don't think he's going to be able, even if he redoubles his efforts, to persuade a Republican member of Congress oh, gee, you know, the president talked to me in a more forceful way, so I think I will vote his way. That's not how they calculate things. That's not how they see things. It might make some little tiny differences on the margins, but these members of Congress, they know where their bread is buttered, and their bread is buttered in their home districts, and they have a finger on the pulse of their districts. That's how they got elected. That's how they intend to get reelected. So, you know, Alice Rivlin mentioned the negotiations that Obama had with Speaker Boehner last year for the so-called grand bargain, where supposedly he did put some fairly serious entitlement cuts on the table, but they were in conjunction with what looked like would be some fairly big revenue increases, which, of course, were the hard part of that so-called bargain for Boehner and the Republicans. Of course, it never came to fruition. I have serious doubts that Boehner ever could have gotten it through his Republican House. But the political context of those talks were the most recent election was the 2010 midterm election, where the Republicans did very, very well and took back the House of Representatives. Now the political context is November's reelection of Barack Obama. And he campaigned on, you know, higher tax rates and that sort of thing. So now we have a very political dynamic.
Francis is calling from West Palm Beach, Florida. Hi, Francis. You're on Point.
Hi, everybody. Compromise is the higher road, obviously, and the Founding Fathers certainly had to compromise. However, in 2010, the Tea Party people came in to the Republican Party representing a minority, acting like they had a mandate to speak for all of us with the mantra, no compromise, our way or the highway. So I feel like the only thing Obama and the Democrats can do is just get some backbone and do whatever it takes to get bold steps to go forward and do what FDR did. I don't see that they're willing to compromise for the majority of people in the country.
Alice Rivlin, a little hard, though, for the president and the Democrats to just simply move their agenda through Congress without at least some Republican backing in this modern age.
Absolutely. And given our Constitution, they will have to find a compromise position. We're not a parliamentary system where you elect a government and it's winner take all and the prime minister gets to say what happens until he is defeated. We don't work that way. We have these checks and balances. We have divided government right now. And the Republicans and the Democrats are going to have to find a mutual accommodation or the country can't move forward. It will be a huge lost opportunity if they don't, because our economy is recovering. We have the prospect of unemployment coming down and economic growth accelerating. But we could lose all that very quickly and fall back into recession if we don't get these major problems solved. And it is going to require a bipartisan compromise.
We're discussing the intense wrangling in Washington right now over the fiscal cliff and what it means if we go over the fiscal cliff at midnight. Let's hear from more On Point listeners to talk about, to hear what they're thinking about the fiscal cliff today. Tony is calling from Omaha, Nebraska. Hi, Tony.
Hi, Bob. I just want to know what nobody's ever talked about, the positive points, so let's go on ahead and go over the cliff. We've got the deficit and everything else. If we go over the cliff, the Republicans will get their cost cuts, the Democrats will get their taxes increased. I only make about $30,000 to $40,000 a year, but I'm willing to pay a couple hundred more a month if it gets our physical house in order. So let's talk about a little bit about going on over the cliff and how that'll take care of our deficit problems.
Alice Rivlin, will going over the cliff take care of our deficit problems?
Well, the caller's right that, yes, it would certainly help on the deficit because, as he says, it would increase taxes on everybody and it would cut spending. Now, the problem is that it would do it too quickly. The economy isn't very strong, and this would give us a dose of rapid deficit reduction rather than a gradual transition to a more sustainable budget. So I think there's some risks. The Congressional Budget Office thinks that if we did this and stuck with it over the next year, that we would likely throw the economy back into recession. That's too much austerity too quickly. But the caller's right. we've got to do something about the future increase of the debt. And this would at least give us a starting point. One argument for going over the cliff is that then we would have these higher tax rates and we could adjust them, but maybe not all the way. And we would have these quite mindless spending cuts. They're equal percentage in all programs. You'd never do it that way if you had a free choice. But you could take those and then do it in a more sensible, more gradual way. So there's some advantages to actually starting from a different point at which you don't have as serious a deficit problem going forward.
Margaret and Chuck, politically going over the fiscal cliff, something that liberals don't mind going over the cliff because entitlements would largely be untouched by budget cuts, and programs that liberals generally don't like, such as the military, take a big hit under sequestration. Do you think this is generally true, that liberals aren't overly upset at the prospect of no deal today? Chuck, you start.
Well, I think for the one thing that the liberals and across the board really don't like is that the tax rates would go up on virtually everyone, because all of the Bush era income tax cuts would expire. And so that's why, you know, the vast majority of Democrats have gone along with President Obama to, they call it, save the tax cuts for the middle class. They're starting the middle class at a rather high number, $250,000 a year, but that's the term that they use. So in that regard, they're not sanguine about this. But you make a good point. There's really some good reason for both Republicans and Democrats to not be too terribly concerned about this fiscal cliff, for both economic reasons, partly because of what Tony pointed out, that, well, it does get us at least on a track to do some deficit reduction, but also for the political reason. And Alice Rivlin has done a nice job of pointing that out. For the Republicans, suddenly they can be voting for tax cuts instead of tax increases, and it gives the Democrats more leverage for that very same reason, the flip side of that coin.
Margaret, you think there's any plus side for liberals in trying to scuttle any deal that comes out of today, if there is a deal?
Because both parties have laid the markers down so firmly on not allowing everyone's taxes to go up, I think it's more of an intellectual exercise than a realistic proposition. I mean, whether it runs out, you know, before the first, and then it takes a few days to patch it together. Look, here's what you don't see these guys rushing to do. You don't see them rushing to change CPI and cut the growth of everyone's Social Security benefits. You don't see them rushing to do major deficit cutting measures. You don't see them rushing to stop these automatic spending cuts. In fact, they're looking to barter these in the fight next month. This is really politics. And that's, I think, what's so frustrating to some of the retiree members and some of the outside budget experts, and to many Americans who are sitting here trying to figure out what's going to happen, because everybody's rushing to protect, you know, tax cuts from going away, when the whole point of the exercise was supposed to be to cut deficits. And so it's also frustrating to many businesses. And when we were talking earlier about what options President Obama has for leveraging Republicans, that is really the one option that he's only seriously begun to mine, because he had such testy relations with Wall Street and CEOs in the first part of his presidency. But they are a real pivot point. And Speaker Boehner does have his own legacy to think about. And Speaker Boehner comes from the school of House Republicans that are, you know, pro-business more than they are highly ideological. For businesses, this is a frustration. They want certainty. They want sort of better balance sheets for the U.S. long term. And as the president and Congress try to figure out what to do long term, I think there is a real chance that the business leaders will be kind of the voice that has some ability to bring the two sides together.
From On Point listeners on Facebook, Chris Becky says, ugh, a bunch of politicians playing politics rather than public servants serving the public. Daphne Red says, the people got what they voted for and will continue to get what they voted for. Frank is on the line now from Boston. Hi, Frank.
Hey, how are you, Bob?
Good, thank you. Go ahead.
This all dog and pony show. I mean, Obama's always wanted to go over the cliff because there's not enough millionaires and billionaires to feed the beast.
What do you mean by that?
Well, we have $17 trillion worth of deficit and counting. I mean, how are we going to pay for it? I mean, when people like Bono leave Ireland because he doesn't want to pay the tax rates, I mean, he's not putting his money where his mouth is, and it's the same thing that's going over here.
Alice,
you're either going to create wealth or you're going to redistribute wealth.
Alice Rivlin, is going over the fiscal cliff, I should say, was going over the fiscal cliff always inevitable, if in fact that's where we are headed at the end of the day today?
Oh, I don't think so. I mean, this fiscal cliff is an artificial thing. The Congress in the Budget Control Act in 2011 made this decision that they wanted to have a forcing mechanism so that they would come together, the Republicans and the Democrats, and fashion a so-called grand bargain to put our budget back on a sustainable track. And the caller's right. In the long run, we have to pay for the government that we want. So they wanted a grand bargain to do that. That's what Boehner and the president were talking about way back then. And they said, if we don't get there, we will have something happen automatically that is so awful that we'll never let it happen. That was the supposition, that this fiscal cliff was a barrier so unattractive in terms of policy that the Congress would never let it happen, the Congress and the president. They'd make the grand bargain. They'd make the compromises, and we would be on a better track. But here we are doing something that no one thought was possible.
Chuck, we've known for 2 years that the tax cuts were expiring tonight at midnight, that the fiscal cliff was coming, even though we weren't necessarily calling it the fiscal cliff 2 years ago. Do you think that anyone in Congress is embarrassed by the fact that we're at the 11th hour and we have no deal?
I think quite a few of them are embarrassed. Maybe the majority are embarrassed. But this is the result of a long, long series of partisan impasses. You know, you go back to the near-death experience on the debt ceiling last year. You go back to the inability of Boehner and Obama to reach a grand bargain. Then we handed things over. Remember the super committee that was going to have all these powers? And Alice Rivlin has gone through some of these things again. They were supposed to be able to do this with their extra powers. They couldn't do it, so they set up this horrible, you know, unacceptable deal called the fiscal cliff, and now we can't seem to get that done. Again, this country has been the partisanship in the Congress, especially in the House, has been increasing bit by bit for years. It largely is because of the changes in our districts that, again, are becoming either far to the right or far to the left, and it just makes compromise that much harder. And again, I hate to sound like I'm beating a dead horse, but for many members of Congress, compromise, instead of being a good thing, can actually be something that will end their political career. That's how divided we've become.
Margaret, do you think there's any regret by members of Congress over passing the fiscal cliff plan 2 years ago, or regret by President Obama for signing it into law?
Because the fiscal cliff sort of came together in a few chunks, it's hard to break it into one point where people would look back on it and think about whether to regret it or not. I mean, part of the fiscal cliff, a large part of the fiscal cliff's creation, was in the context of the last debt ceiling, debt limit fight. And look, if you can imagine what would have happened if they wouldn't have reached an agreement on that, we're talking about paying back money we owe that we already spent. I mean, and in some ways, that was the more unimaginable fight to have, even now, you know, even as we're staring down midnight and thinking, how do we get to this point? You know, that was like the super crazy fight, and we're about to have it again in another month. And so, boy, where do you pinpoint the regret? Does a member of leadership pinpoint the regret when he didn't decide to challenge his own caucus and perhaps risk losing, you know, his leadership position? Does a retiring member look back and say, you know what, I should have known I was retiring anyway. I should have just crossed the line and voted for that. Or, you know, where do you pinpoint the regret? When you look at the history of deal making, there are so many different ways that bipartisan deals have come together over the years. Nobody wants it to be like it is now, but nobody knows how to stop it either.
Let's take another caller. Cindy is on the line from Nashville, Tennessee. Hi, Cindy.
Hi, Bob. Margaret just made part of the point I wanted to make about the debt ceiling fight. Coming from Tennessee, we have sent some of the more embarrassing members to Congress, and I apologize to the country for that, but I had no part in it personally. But what really frustrates me is hearing a lot of the Congress people around here during the debt ceiling fight say that, you know, that we're holding the line against Obama having a blank check and everything, and this is just a dishonest representation of what the debt ceiling is. It's not allowing the president to spend more. It's allowing the president to pay the debts we've already incurred, and I think that they make a lot of hay out of that deliberate misrepresentation, and that angers and frustrates me, and I think the president needs to perhaps do a better job of pointing out just exactly what the raising the debt ceiling is and what it means, and not allowing these people to continue this, frankly, lie about the debt ceiling. And remember that that is what brought us to this ridiculous self-inflicted wound.
Alice Rivlin, let me ask you a question. All across America, Americans are expressing disgust and are very critical about the inability of Democrats and Republicans to work together to come up with some sort of agreement on this. And we just hear a little bit of that from Cindy. As individuals, do you think members of Congress feel that, or more to the point, do they even care about public sentiment?
Oh, I think many members of Congress, and especially members of the Senate, want to work across the aisle and get these problems behind us. I served on the Simpson-Bowles Commission, as you noted at the beginning, and that had large group of senators who were really eager to work together. They included Dick Durbin from Illinois, who is a liberal Democrat, Tom Coburn from Oklahoma, who's a conservative Republican, and Mike Crapo from Idaho, equally conservative. They all signed the Simpson-Bowles report, which had a viable compromise on the big debt problem, getting our economy, getting our budget back on a sustainable track so that the debt is not rising faster than the economy is growing. That required a lot of compromise. And I thought that Tom Coburn said it best when he signed the report. He said, there's a lot in this I don't like, I think meaning the tax increases. But if we're going to solve the problem, Tom Coburn isn't going to get everything he wants. I thought that put it very well. And that group in the Senate, later called the Gang of Six, the Gang of Eight, whatever, has been working very hard to craft a compromise. But at the moment, they're not winning. The compromise isn't coming together. And the House, as several people have noted, is much more partisan.
Margaret and Chuck, let me ask you one last question to both of you. After all the posturing on this and all the posturing to come, who's likely to get the blame in the eyes of the public if there is no deal? And Chuck, you first.
Well, I think the Republicans are in the greater danger, and the polls will show this. Again, the president just won re-election campaigning on some of the things, especially the higher tax rates that he's called for. The Republicans looked really bad in the House the other day when Speaker Boehner couldn't get his own bill, the Plan B, through. That did not look good, and I think it sort of underscored the very strong, or some would say extreme, position that Republicans take on these issues. Now, if the economy really goes into the tank, inevitably it's always the president who's more on the hook for that. But I think the short run is the Republicans are in the greatest political jeopardy.
And Margaret?
I think that's right, but I think President Obama is also looking at the long run now. He's not running for re-election. He's looking to build his legacy. How will the history books remember what he did in this time of great economic distress? And for many Republicans, they're frustrated to see him demagogue the issues. After all, he didn't exactly take Simpson-Bowles and run with it. He just sat on it for a year, right, and then blamed them. And so is President Obama going to spend next year going out telling people what he really wants to do? I want to begin to raise everyone's taxes, and I want to begin to rein in the growth of entitlements. and it's difficult, and you might not like me for it.
I have time. I have time for just this: a yes or no on a deal or a no deal. Margaret, yes or no?
Yes, but not clear how fast, if by midnight or not.
Chuck, yes or no?
No.
Alice Rivlin, yes or no?
Yes, but maybe not immediately.
You can join the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, On Point Radio. Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Thanks to our three guests. We appreciate it on this New Year's Eve day. I'm Bob Oakes, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.